Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, cities turn to technology to solve problems and help their residents.
And why Dry January is still a thing, and how you can take a different approach to it.
But first, birth rates have been falling here in the U.S. and around the world for a long time. And with all of the modern-day challenges of having kids, from budget to lack of government support, it makes sense. But our next guest this morning says it is not true for everyone. Catherine Pakolik is an economist at Catholic University of America and author of the new book, Hannah's Children. And for it, Pakolik, a mother of eight herself, talked to 55 college-educated women who have five or more children to find out why. They represent about 5% of the population, and she told me their stories point to broader questions about meaning and identity in having kids.
This was a really important group to study because with the falling birth rates all around the world, there's a really important question that policymakers are asking, which is, you know, is there anything we can do about this decline in fertility? And so one of the interesting questions is like, who doesn't fit this trend? Who looks different? And so going around and talking to people and figuring out like, what makes you tick? Why would you do this? This is a really important piece of the story.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to dig into that more. But talk first about some of those misconceptions. And I'm completely guilty of this as well. I have little kids. Like, I'm around other mothers and other families a lot. And once in a while, you'll see a family with a bunch of kids like this. And I'll always kind of wonder, like, why? So do they feel judged? Like, what kinds of misconceptions do people have?
Yeah, for sure. They do feel judged. It turned out that that was a really common theme. People look at larger families and they tend to think either, you know, didn't have any other options in life. Like that was just, that was the best thing they could come up with to do. Didn't want to work, didn't have a job or a career. Or they think, you know, ignorant, don't know how this works. Women get that question all the time in public. Like, don't you know how this happens? Which you know, kind of funny if it's said in one way, but also, you know, can be a little insulting if you hear it over and over, you know, don't you know how children happen? And then, you know, maybe the last like misconception that people get a lot is sort of, are you against family planning? Are people who have lots of kids so sort of against the modern world, like they're Amish or something, right? That kind of idea. So I think those are all, you know, things that I think are misconceptions, but people get them all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And talk about some of the women you talked to, 55 women here, college educated women who chose these larger families. You are among these women, I should say. And yes. And they talked about these misconceptions, I'm sure, about this feeling of judgment, but none of that really turned out to be true.
Right. Of course, you know, everybody's story is a little bit different, but the misconceptions aren't true. These are women who, some of them are full-time work. Some of them are doing part-time work. Some of them used to work full-time and don't now. All kinds of different varieties of things, different religious faiths, but certainly not a kind of theme of rejecting the modern world. Not people who are like living under a rock or didn't want to modernize or drive cars or something like that. So yeah, they, you know, in a sense, like if you met them without their children in public, most of the people I talked to, I think would just strike you as sort of ordinary people.
Let me ask you about the broader context you brought up there, which is this idea that we are in fact at this moment seeing birth rates fall dramatically. This has been happening for a long time in our country. It's happening even more dramatically in some other countries around the world. And it makes sense in lots of ways, right? Like we don't have social supports for families. We don't often have parental leave when people have kids. Like women also just have more options than they used to have.
Right.
I wonder, what did the people that you interviewed about this have to say about why they did this?
You know, obviously, all the things that you just mentioned, I think, are really important and part of the conversation about falling birth rates. This is one of the reasons economists think more or less, you know, these birth rates have been falling, as you say, for a really long time. This isn't just something that happened since the Great Recession or even something that happened, you know, in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years, but it's a couple of hundred years. And the way to think about it is children aren't needed anymore. Like you can live a complete happy life without children. In the past, that would have been difficult. not merely because of social norms or expectations, but actually more importantly, sort of for labor, for help around the house, for domestic chores, for support in your old age, right? I mean, those are all things you couldn't have taken for granted without children in your life. And so when you think about human decision making, we do things because we need them or because we want them. And so then if children aren't needed as much, then the really interesting thing is, well, who wants them? Like, and why do they want them? And what are the kinds of things that could motivate you to want them? And this is where in my data, what emerged was kind of a layered picture. But one of the really important themes was this idea of biblical faith, a kind of maybe a traditional kind of biblical faith that says children are really blessings in your life. And a blessing is the sort of thing that you wouldn't just want to have once. You know, if you be blessed, you'd like to be blessed more than once. Women who describe their children as blessings in that biblical way were kind of like, well, all things being equal, if my health is good, if our resources are good, why wouldn't we have the next one? And I think that's really different. I think that's a really interesting phenomenon. And it certainly opened my eyes to a broad spectrum of women of different faiths who shared that central idea about children.
Was it often about faith for most of these women?
Yes. Well, it was about 95% of my sample.
Yeah.
It was about faith, or at least I would say it was drawn from faith. I like to say it was kind of drawn from faith. One woman said it was kind of underneath her religion or her kind of coming like at this basis. Many women shared being drawn to particular churches because in a sense they had this almost visceral sense that childbearing was so important and that they really gravitated towards churches that celebrated the intrinsic goodness of children and childbearing. Mm-hmm. Because of course they did draw a lot of social support from their church networks and friends. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about your own story here and your own personal experience in this. I mentioned you are also a mother of eight. I'm sure that is probably part of what sparked your interest in this, right? Mm-hmm. But yes. How did your own experience play into reporting this and your motivation?
Yeah. Well, you know, as I was kind of thinking about what I could add as a scholar and a researcher to this puzzle, right, because it has been a real puzzle for demographers to think about how low can birth rates go and why are they going quite so low? I was thinking, what can I bring to the table? And, you know, we have this persistent truth in the social sciences, which is that if you're going to interview people, it's vastly better to bring a team of interviewers who are able to be received without judgment. I mean, so that, yeah. You know, so you kind of walk in, it's like, look, I'm not judging you. I've made the same life choices. I don't know how to perfectly describe why I did this, but boy, you know, your children are great. Tell me about it. So I thought like, well, this is a comparative advantage that I have. So I thought, okay, I could do this. This would be really interesting.
Yeah.
And let's see what we find. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what you're getting at here in the book is also larger, right? Like it's looking at this economic question, right? Which is kind of your specialty about the future of American prosperity, what it means that birth rates are so low, what it means for the future of our country. Should we assume that this is a bad thing, that birth rates going down will negatively affect, at least economically, our country's future?
So I'll say this. I'll say economists are in uncharted territory on that. Most people do assume it's a bad thing. Most of the economists, demographers, political scientists assume it's a bad thing. We don't think you can have sustained economic growth with a declining working population. I want to really stress our working population is already declining. Not only are your welfare programs stressed, you know, it's much harder for us to think about carving up tax payments from current workers to pay for so many retired workers, but, you know, we don't think you can have prolonged economic growth and prosperity with a shrinking workforce. Since all the countries in the world are converging very rapidly to the same demographic patterns we have here, you know, there's no like immigration story that changes this. So it, you know, it's probably going to be a bad thing, but I also want to say we have no data on this.
Right.
Never happened. It's never happened.
All right. That is Catherine Bacalik, an economist at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., also author of the new book, Hannah's Children, The Women Quietly Defying the Birth Dearth. Catherine, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
You're so welcome.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, an author is taking a psychological approach to becoming alcohol-free.
But first, when Tori Olson was a kid, he loved playing video games. In his words, they were a, quote, obsession. He played so much that he had to force himself to quit for fear that it would derail his college career. Once he put the controller down, he didn't pick it up again for 20 years. After he went cold turkey, Olson didn't just make it through college, he got a PhD in history. He figured his video game career was over. But just when he thought he was out, his old friends pulled him back in. During the COVID-19 pandemic, Olson decided the world had already gone sideways. What harm could his old obsession really do? He fired up a video game called Red Dead Redemption 2, which tells the story of a 19th century outlaw named Arthur Morgan. Olson wasn't looking for much more than a distraction from the horrors of the pandemic, but he got way more than he bargained for. As an expert in post-Civil War American history, Olson was genuinely impressed by Red Dead Redemption 2's narrative, which forces players to confront issues like Gilded Age corporate capitalism, the clash between American settlers and indigenous communities in the West, the messiness of Reconstruction, and a whole host of other issues. And what's more, Olson says, the game does all this with a level of sensitivity and nuance that's hard to find almost anywhere in popular culture, let alone video games. Olson was so blown away by Red Dead Redemption 2 that he wrote a whole book about it. It's called Red Dead's History, A Video Game, An Obsession, and America's Violent Past. I spoke with him about the book last year, and I began by asking him about a key moment in the game, when the outlaw, Arthur Morgan, meets a black merchant who's just been robbed by a group of white men.
And, you know, Arthur sympathizes, and he's like, that sounds awful. And then the doctor says, well, you know, it's not as awful as the punishment that they offered me, the crucifixion, defenestration, this long list of, you know, really awful, shockingly violent physical punishments. And he's like, well, you know, I got off easy. I didn't get that, right? And the game doesn't do any more than that. It just hints at this threat that hung in the air. But for me, as a historian of the American South, that veiled threat was really fascinating because it's an allusion to the institution of lynching. And in fact, the 1890s were the single bloodiest decade of lynching in the entirety of Southern history. So 1899, the moment when the game is set, is very much a time and place when this threat of extreme physical violence was on the minds of pretty much every black man and woman in the South.
Well, so this for me gets at an element of your book that I found really compelling, which is the way that Red Dead Redemption is almost more of a leitmotif than kind of the central focus of the narrative, I would argue. It becomes this way of interrogating the oversimplified narratives that we often accept when it comes to American history. And one of the biggest examples of this for me was the sequence where you talk about the Civil War monuments in St. Denis, which is a fictional version of New Orleans in the game. Yeah. Now, obviously, in our actual world, there is an ongoing conversation about whether or not those monuments should still stand in the places where they do. But you make the case that in Red Dead Redemption 2, there is an invitation to consider the truth of what those monuments actually represent and that they might be more evidence of mythology than history.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's really fascinating that the developers of Red Dead Redemption 2 chose to include in every urban or small town space in the Deep South these large-scale monuments to the Confederacy. These monuments were erected at a very significant rate across the South, beginning really in the 1890s. That's surprising to a lot of folks because you might imagine that, oh, directly after the Civil War is when the South started, you know, commemorating the Confederacy. But that's actually not true. These large public monuments in the center of towns and cities only really begins like 25 years after the war is over. And those statues are, of course, closely affiliated with something we call the Lost Cause. The Lost Cause is this sort of airbrushed, whitewashed mythology that claimed that the Civil War wasn't about slavery, that the Confederacy's cause was noble, that it was justified, really removing the realities of what the Civil War was actually all about. And as I lay out in the book, there is a reason why it happens in the 1890s. It's not a coincidence. It's not just happenstance that it took 25, 30 years to begin that campaign. It was very much a response to threats that many white Southerners perceived to the institution of white supremacy. They worried that poor blacks and poor whites would come together in this third-party political movement, and they worried that as more black Southerners were making more money and buying land, that it was also chipping away at white power and control. So it's really in an attempt to kind of shore up white supremacy and to, you know, deflect this threat that this construction of monuments and, you know, installation of Confederate flags all over the place takes place.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so interesting because, you know, the charge that gets leveled at people who want to take those monuments down in the present discourse about it is that it would be a kind of revisionist history to do so, and that we ought to leave them standing because they represent something that actually happened. But your book and the game, by extension, became this way for me of coming into an awareness that the monuments themselves are an act of revisionist history.
Absolutely. They're an act of mythology, not of history.
Lest we get too far down the road of making it sound like this is sort of an unalloyed work of praise, I do think we should talk about how, in spite of all the unexpected sophistication in the game, it really, as you point out towards the end of the book, drops the ball when it comes to its portrayal of Appalachia.
Yeah, absolutely. But when they get to the southern mountains, mm-hmm. they can't resist the urge yeah. to lampoon rural, white, working class Southerners. And I should say, this is a long pattern within Rockstar's games, going back to the earliest Grand Theft Auto games from the 1990s, which I, of course, played while I was in high school.
Sure.
There's just been this common assumption that Appalachian people, especially white mountain folks from the rural South, are the sort of last acceptable stereotype, the last acceptable prejudice. Like, it's always okay to make fun out of this group. And I really disagree with that. The makings of sort of poverty and inequality within the region is very much the byproduct of this sort of expansion of large external corporations into this region for very greedy self-serving motives, right? Of stripping right. timber and coal and other natural resources for the sake of making people outside of Appalachia quite wealthy. And the scars that that leaves on Appalachia are pretty profound. We still live with them to the current day.
And it's surprising given the level of thought that seems to have gone into these other sequences that when it comes to this particular region where there is an equally fascinating and thought-provoking history to explore, it kind of resorts back to these Cletus the Slack-jawed yokel-type portrayals.
Right. Toothless, shoeless, long-bearded, archaic, preserved in amber, hillbilly, right? I mean, that is the myth. But I will say there is a saving grace in Red Dead Redemption 2's portrayal of Appalachia, which is that yes, they recycle all those sort of cliches, but then they also show that in the 1890s, this region is being torn apart by external interests, particularly Leviticus Cornwall, the sort of robber baron of the game. His name is everywhere in Appalachia, just like it was in the West. Mm-hmm. It's his company that's running the coal mine. It's his company, the timber companies that are leaving these massive fields of stumps of these, vanished forests as a result. So the game does show, it does sort of gesture toward, well, this region is not just isolated. It is being integrated very violently and rapidly into the American economy. And, maybe that has something to do with the poverty that people see. But, of course, it doesn't go all the way. But I do in my book.
Well, speaking of the book, in closing, I thought it might be nice to have you share a quote with us that comes on page 239, which felt to me like kind of a thesis statement. And this is a section where you're talking about the dangers of being lazy about historical stereotypes in the way that you're arguing Rockstar does when it comes to these Appalachian characters. And it begins, when we retell familiar tales like this.
When we retell familiar tales like this, they might seem harmlessly innocent, but they flatten the nuance and drama of the past, and they whisk away the political and economic engines that drove violence in 19th century America. They make the past seem simpler than it actually was, and that's a danger if we wish to understand our present.
Well, Tori Olson is an American history professor at the University of Tennessee and the author of Red Dead's History. Tori, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure.
So, maybe you, like me, are a gamer, and that conversation with Tori Olson provided a sense of relief. Maybe our predilection for spending hours wandering through imaginary worlds isn't a waste of time. Maybe it's actually intellectually justifiable. We're not just playing make-believe, we're learning about history. But is playing make-believe a waste of time? Is there not an equally viable argument for using video games to learn about ourselves? Matt Bell thinks there is. His obsession of choice is Baldur's Gate 2, a video game that takes place in a Dungeons & Dragons-style fantasy world. Baldur's Gate and D&D are role-playing games, also known as RPGs. In these games, players build their characters from scratch based on a wide range of options that can be configured in almost limitless combinations. The actual gameplay becomes an act of collective imagination between the players. Once everyone has decided who they are, another player creates a quest for the characters, and they have to make a constant stream of decisions about how their character might behave as the quest unfolds. In a video game like Baldur's Gate 2, the computer creates the quest, but the story still changes based on the choices that individual players make about who they are and how they want to navigate the world. Matt Bell spent more hours than he can count playing games like this as a kid, and as an adult, he still does. There was a time, he told me recently, when he thought this time spent playing RPGs would prevent him from becoming a responsible grown-up. But these days, he's thriving as an author and a professor, and he has realized that he has games like Baldur's Gate 2 to thank.
You know, role-playing games can be a place for trying on different versions of yourself or even selves you would like never be. Your character has like a really minor sort of pre-given backstory. And then really, in some ways, you're inventing the backstory by making choices in the present, right? Like, you know, like in Dungeons & Dragons, there's a character class called a paladin, where you basically have to be like the most lawful, most good version of yourself, and trying to play a character who always made like the most noble decision. Or you could be a wizard who craved power over more than anything else, and sort of in every scenario, making a choice that like moved you closer to whatever you perceive power to be.
Okay, but so what's really fascinating to me about this is you're talking about this phenomenon of how the great fun of a game like Baldur's Gate 2 is that you are inventing kind of in real time a backstory for this character to understand how they relate to the world and might behave in the present. But you also write that, quote, I believed that growing up meant divorcing yourself from who you were before. And that's a sensibility that you had not in a gaming sense, just like as a person moving through the world. What do you make of the fact that the game was teaching you, and tell me if you disagree with this, what life actually is, which is that you can't divorce yourself from who you were before?
I mean, I think you're right. I think, you know, in the book I talk about feeling like fantasy or science fiction or things were like childish or something and I was supposed to grow out of them, which I do not believe in any way now. As a fiction writer, when I started letting those influences from fantasy and science fiction and myth and fairy tales and all these other things back into my writing kind of came alive.
Yes.
And when I was trying to write without the things I loved, it was like writing with my hands tied behind my back.
Yeah, yeah. Another favorite quote from the book, you say, I wonder what it's cost me to refuse so strongly what once mattered so much. Could you maybe give us an example of a moment in your life as a writer where you did decide to let those youthful influences in and where you felt like your capacity as a storyteller or as an artist came alive?
Yeah, I think one of the ways I would invent characters is just like on the first page, have the character do something I would never do. Like if I'm timid about approaching strangers, just have like the character immediately like approach a stranger and start talking to them in a way that I would not. And then you're like, okay, this is a different person now. They're making choices I would not. What other things are different about them?
Yeah. Well, so kind of at the other end of the spectrum, though, you know, we've been talking about these various ways in which this far-fetched world of gaming actually has a lot of real-world analogs and serves as like pretty good prep for life as an adult, particularly life as an artist like yourself. But you also point out that there are some ways in which games like Baldur's Gate 2 function that are not particularly authentic to life in the real world. In particular, this idea that the narrative in the game revolves entirely around your character. Like there's entire regions of the map that don't exist until you discover them. And if you are on a quest to, say, rescue somebody from a dungeon, it doesn't matter when you do it, as long as you get to it eventually. Like the idea that they might be suffering in the time that you take to get to them is sort of right. Not acknowledged. How did you start to make sense of that piece of it as you got older?
I think in some ways when I was younger, I do think I thought the world revolved around me in lots of ways, right? And I do think, you know, we don't always ascribe the same complexity to other people that we give ourselves. Like, and I think it's actually kind of an act of will to remember that everyone is as complicated as you are and everybody else is going through their own 15 emotions every time they do something. And I think that took me a long time to learn, which even though the game treats you as like the most important person in the world, I still think like playing as lots of different kinds of characters is a way of understanding the complexity of others. Or what would it feel like to be this kind of person? What would it be like to make these kinds of decisions?
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, that there is a way in which you can treat games like this as an opportunity to broaden your empathy and, you know, almost literally walk through the world in the shoes or boots of a bunch of different kinds of beings. But it's that you have to choose to do that. In a similar vein, one of the other things that you bring up in the book that I really appreciated that I don't think it's talked about enough when it comes to this type of game specifically is violence. As you write, you say, quote, in Baldur's Gate 2, you are both the victim of great acts of violence and also violence's greatest perpetrator, killing your way across every realm you roam. And I thought that was very fascinating because we hear a lot about discourse in terms of violence in video games when it comes to fighting games like Mortal Kombat, where the whole point is like, you face off against one other person and you're just supposed to gore them until they're dead.
right.
But this is different. This is, violence is a part of moving through the world just as much as forging political allegiances is or falling in love. How has it affected your relationship to violence, particularly as a writer?
I remember reading one time about the game God of War, which I played and liked, you know, but really all you can do is jump and hit things, right? Like it's very violent. And I remember reading somewhere like to beat the game, you have to hit the attack button like 2 million times, right? Like 2 million times you have to choose to attack something. And like that idea sounds crazy, right? Like, you know, like that's like a weird choice to make over and over. You know, I played video games my whole life. I think there are some things that I'm not super interested in playing anymore. Like I'm not a shooter person. I don't want to even do play gun violence, things like that. But I do think about violence a lot in my work. And I write about it because, not because I like it, but because I'm scared of it, right? Or I'm writing about a thing that bothers me in the world. And so I'm thinking about it a lot that way. And I'm often trying to make it like unenjoyable in some way, or so that it's not, like pornographic violence. It's not something that's like exciting. It's a weird thing. I'm trying to write it well, but not in a way that it's like fun, if that makes sense. And obviously in a video game, like you wouldn't design combat that wasn't fun. And I think there is a tension between that. There's a name for it that's very fancy, ludonarrative dissonance, right? Where the dissonance between the gameplay and the story it's telling becomes sort of noticeable by the player.
That's interesting. I love that term, ludonarrative dissonance. I'm writing that down. But it speaking of dissonance, that realization that you're describing that there is this kind of inherent tension in the way that the narrative of a game like Baldur's Gate is put together, that it has the violence has to be fun or else you wouldn't play it. That seems like a very real and mature recognition on your part, and also like something that you maybe couldn't have arrived at without playing so many hours of Baldur's Gate.
Right.
Well, Matt Bell is a professor at ASU and the author of the book Baldur's Gate 2. Matt, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Cities across the valley and around the world are looking to technology to help solve their problems and make life better for the residents. And our next guest says those cities are paying attention to what others are doing, what's working and what's not. Rob Walker is the author of the book City Tech. It's based on columns of the same name he's written for the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy. He spoke with our co-host Mark Brody about what he found, and they started with how robustly he would say cities across the U.S. are trying to embrace tech and to try to solve some of their problems.
Well, quite robustly and more so every year. I started doing this research that led to the book in 2015. And I would say year over year, we've seen more interest from city governments, more interest from and participation from citizens, and more variety in the ways that cities, you know, use quote unquote technology, what technology means, because it's come to encompass, you think of apps and maps and things like this, but it has also come to encompass different materials and different planning strategies and all kinds of things. So quite a bit is the answer to your original question.
Well, are there particular categories that you're finding cities are really trying to use tech for, like you mentioned, you know, things like maps or communication or maybe different building materials? Like, are there particular things that cities do where they're more likely to look to tech than others?
Well, there are a couple of, you know, sort of thematic areas of interest. One that comes up, not surprisingly, more than once is, let's just say, transportation, this broad category. But we've seen experiments with everything from different kinds of technology in the mass transportation space, electric buses. The book is global, so there's a lot of examples of that in Latin America. But also, the pandemic caused a big rethink in a lot of cities about managing the curb, they call it, which isn't necessarily the vehicle type, although it can mean different vehicle types, but also just the logistics of how can we get deliveries to be coordinated in an efficient way and make efficient use of curb space in a downtown area when traffic patterns are changing rapidly? And one of the interesting things about that was it led to all kinds of you know, different technologies for parking monitoring and stuff like that, which sounds pretty mundane, but it can make a big difference. And that pandemic era taught city planners and people who watch city planning, maybe something that planners already knew, but is that cities can be much more nimble than we, than the pop culture version of parks and recreation or whatever would have you believe. They really can move quite quickly and decisively and experimentally. You know, some of the things in the book didn't work out exactly as planned. And that's okay, because that's the nature of, if you're gonna sort of make progress, you have to take some false steps along the way. And I think we've seen an increasing willingness to do that.
I want to ask you about that nimbleness, because I wonder if in some ways it's easier for cities to experiment with tech or just try something than it would be, for example, for like a county or a state to do something, even if it's the same kind of thing.
Well, I would say that's probably, you know, that's going to differ by municipality. But I think that what we've seen is, I would say across the board in various governing structures, more of a willingness to work with private side partners. And then I would flip that around and say that I think that there's been an evolution in private companies commercial companies that operate in ways that impact city plans and designs to form partnerships rather than do the kind of cliche version of what we think of with Uber and Airbnb in the early days, just kind of showing up and causing cities to react.
You mentioned the word mundane related to like, you know, parking and parking meters, things like that. But it seems as though some of these things, reading through the book, some of these things that cities have used tech to try to do, yes, they might be kind of run-of-the-mill mundane things, but many of them have a real practical impact in people's day-to-day lives.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of examples. One of my favorite things in the book is an outfit called Co-Urbanize, which uses technology, and this was a pre-pandemic enterprise that's still going strong now, but their focus was getting more civic involvement in city planning because plans for parks and spaces and other development uses will have more favorable outcomes if you get more citizen involvement. So they were pioneering the creation of that put signage in a physical space and have a QR code on it that would let someone go to a site that could see the full plans and weigh in, have citizen feedback. So on one level, that's mundane. On another level, that's pretty exciting. And it really does create involvement. And then on a totally different kind of example, some of the things in the book include stuff that honestly, when I first wrote about it, I thought would be kind of science fiction-y, 3D printed housing.
Mm-hmm.
That has continued to catch on. And there are finished assembled houses being lived in, which addresses a real city crisis these days, which
right.
is affordable housing.
What are city leaders saying about the use of technology and privacy, especially as it relates to data, in terms of making sure that they can use the tech to, you know, achieve what they want to achieve, maybe streamline government, make people's interactions with the city more efficient, but at the same time, protecting, you know, the residents' data and the city's data?
Well, the big flagship story around this privacy issue was, and it is covered in the book. When I wrote about it initially, it was still in progress, which was this partnership between municipal entities in Toronto and Google's Sidewalk Labs, which was their sort of tech forward city of the future enterprise, which had a lot of really fascinating ideas, but did depend heavily on sensors and measuring movement and things that really made people squeamish about, about their privacy. And in that case, I think there was kind of that was a watershed for realizing we can't just charge ahead without really giving serious thought to privacy, or even the most, you know, hyped project will crumble, which that partnership eventually did. And I think that the lesson coming out of that is that there's more of a awareness that these entities need to partner with each other and trust each other from the beginning and not try to cobble together that trust late in the game.
All right. That is Rob Walker, author of the book City Tech. Rob, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. It is January, and for lots of people each year, that means it is dry January. The trend to give up alcohol for the first month of the year has been gaining popularity, and our next guest has been a part of many of those conversations. Annie Grace is a best-selling author and founder of This Naked Mind, and she advocates for a less conventional and sometimes controversial approach to reevaluating your relationship with alcohol. Last January, I spoke with her more about it, beginning with her own journey with drinking.
Yeah, I didn't even really drink much in college, but I found myself in New York City and I was told by a boss that going out to happy hour was kind of like the golf course. It's where the deals were done. So I made myself a literal plan to go out, have a glass of wine, a glass of water. And over the next decade, alcohol just became part of my life. It started to replace all of my coping mechanisms. And fast forward a decade, I was very successful in my career, but I was also drinking two bottles of wine pretty much every single night.
Wow. Wow. What was it that kind of pushed you over the edge and made you think, like, I don't want to do this anymore?
There was one moment and one of many, where I asked my four-year-old son to come sit on my lap, and he told me, "Oh, Mom, I don't want to. You smell bad and your teeth are purple." And that was one of these tiny little moments that started to kind of pile up. And I thought, all right, well, this is costing more than it's giving, and I'm just going to cut back, which should be easy. The reality is I didn't find it easy, at least not at first. I found it kind of like being on a diet for alcohol. It was, I felt like I was deprived and I was missing out when I was trying to stop drinking with the traditional sort of willpower method.
Hmm. So, right, you take a somewhat controversial approach to sobriety, right? Like, you don't tell people they need to quit cold turkey or not drink anything in order to sort of reevaluate the way they think about alcohol, right?
Yeah, in fact, the first step of my approach is exactly what I did in my own life, which is I stopped trying to stop drinking. Mm. I stopped with the rules and the blame and the broken promises because I was just digging myself this hole of making rules for myself, like no drinks till Thursday or only two glasses of wine. And I'd keep them for a few days, but then I'd break them. And so when I really changed, I actually stopped trying to stop drinking and I did something very different. I looked at alcohol and I said, why? Why does this have such a hold on me and in my life when it didn't used to? And I actually spent the next year researching the why. Hmm. And through that discovery, through that information, I was able to very easily let it go. And that's what I teach people to do.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about your work and the way that you address this with other people. I mean, it sounds pretty simple to sort of say to yourself, like, you know, why am I doing this? Not for any good reasons, and therefore I won't anymore. But there's, I'm sure, a lot more to it.
Absolutely. Well, I discovered that our desire is really buried in our subconscious. And so we have been more or less programmed since before we can remember that alcohol is beneficial, that it relaxes us, that it helps us have a good time, that it helps us be better at work. And all of these things combine to this feeling of deprivation and missing out when you try to take a break or stop drinking. Mm. And so when I was discovering, wow, actually alcohol, the net result of it is more, not less stress. It's actually making me less happy over time because things without alcohol are more of a bummer. And I was looking at like what is happening neurologically in the brain. All of those things started to really unwind my subconscious belief systems. And so I very naturally just felt like I didn't want to drink anymore. And it is a process that did take me a long time and it takes people some time, but it's amazing how many unquestioned beliefs we have around alcohol.
Hmm. So for you, it was about research more than anything. Like you had to prove to yourself there was a good reason not to do this. And then did something switch in your head at some point? You said, "What? I don't want this anymore."
Well, the first big switch was recognition that I wasn't broken. Hmm. And I think that's where so many of us don't even start the conversation, because we think if we even want to look at our drinking, it means we have a problem, we're an alcoholic, we're broken, there's something wrong with us. And the first thing I discovered is that like very few people are actually chemically addicted to alcohol, less than 10% of excessive drinkers, according to the CDC. And most of us are just doing the best we can with the tools we have. We've just been given this tool called alcohol to medicate literally everything in our lives. And so from that premise that I wasn't actually broken, that there was nothing wrong with me, it awakened this curiosity of, okay, well, why am I doing this more than I think I should? And that ignited the research, which, yes, really eventually changed my mindset, which made it easy for me to stop.
Yeah, yeah. I've read that people in the AA community often don't like your approach to this because it is not about cold turkey quitting or not doing it altogether. How is that different? Like, you change the mindset, but are you telling folks, you know, just cut back and that's also helpful?
Any amount of drinking less is super helpful. Mm-hmm. Now, if you've been drinking for a long time, that might result in you feeling very deprived and missing out. One of the things about AA, the pushback I got is you're telling people they don't have to go to meetings. Mm-hmm. But for me, when I was drinking and I was faced with, okay, I'm going to actually in some ways make alcohol more important when I'm not drinking it by going and meeting about it and talking about it and staying entrenched in this quote, alcoholic lifestyle, even though I'm not drinking alcohol anymore, that didn't feel like freedom to me. Hmm. I really just wanted alcohol to be small and irrelevant in my life. And that was what I ended up attaining. And again, not through meetings.
So you're sort of talking to the, not the 10%, right, who have a chemical addiction to alcohol, but the rest who maybe just have an unhealthy relationship with alcohol.
Exactly. And I think one of my big goals for myself and for the people who, you know, come toward my work is to back up the conversation, right? We don't need to have sort of broken our arm if our wrist hurts to go into a doctor. Mm. We don't need to have to become, you know, rock bottom alcoholic for us to start asking a far better question, in my opinion, than am I an alcoholic, which is, would my life be better if I drank a bit less? And if we remove the fear of that question, then a lot of us can actually look at our relationship with alcohol more mindfully. You know, we know more about ibuprofen or Advil than we do about alcohol. And so all I'm suggesting is just education before you decide what you're going to do and how your relationship with alcohol is going to look.
That's a really interesting approach. So tell us a little bit about Dry January, which I know you have talked a lot about, I'm sure, this month and every January for many years now. But I mean, why do you think it's taken off in recent years? Like, why do you think at the beginning of the year everybody says, oh, maybe I'll try this?
Well, the beginning of the year is just obviously such a mental reset for people. And when we overdo it over the holidays, you know, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving is the heaviest drinking day of the year in the United States. And so when we have all of that kind of hangovers and lethargy coming into the new year, a lot of us are starting to think, well, maybe this would be a good move. You know, a lot of times, though, when we go into a dry January without looking curiously at our behavior, or if we're going into it as almost proving to ourselves, okay, if I can make it 30 days, then I don't have a problem. We're entering into it and we're really setting ourselves up for being on an alcohol diet for the entire month of January. And just like diet rebounds in weight gain, that can rebound in more drinking. So I suggest like more of an experimental approach, a much more mindful approach to saying, okay, I'm going to try to, you know, maybe not drink as much or drink nothing for January, but I'm really going to look at the reasons I'm drinking in the first place. Like, and is it helping? Is it doing the things I'm thinking that it does for me?
That's really interesting. What's your advice for people who might be thinking about this? You talk about the sober, curious folks, right? Like, where do you start?
First of all, let yourself off the hook. If you have any shame or guilt or blame or inkling, maybe I'm broken, just realize you're not. And from that place of self-compassion, you can really awaken curiosity. And I even recommend that people go and time a drink, right? Have that drink, time how long it makes you feel good. Chances are it's less than 20 minutes because of how the brain works with your blood alcohol rising for less than 20 minutes. And then it starts to fall and it makes you feel bad. And when you start to notice, oh, actually the net of this drink is that I feel worse than before I had it, just those little experiments, that level of curiosity in your own life can really change your mindset around alcohol pretty effortlessly.
That's really interesting. All right. A good place to start for anyone interested. That is Annie Grace, bestselling author and founder of This Naked Mind, joining us. Annie, appreciate you coming on. Happy January.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.